Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup where we discuss some of the top stories of the week. And joining me in the studio this morning is Paul Pronovo, editor-in-chief of the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Sean.
And I think we should probably start right off with the big story of the morning, and that's the casino debate. The state Senate last night voted to support 3 resort casinos in separate geographical areas of the state.
Right. I was thinking about this story driving down and trying to come up with a way to frame it. And, you know, to borrow the jingle from Foxwoods, you know, it's not exactly time to pop the cork and fingers snapping. But it's a major step forward for casino gambling in Massachusetts. And of course, it took 8 days to debate this in the Senate. And you know, that's a little bit surprising in the sense that Senate President Terry Murray, who, of course, represents parts of Cape Cod, she had that infamous ka-ching moment where she was at a Boston Area Chamber of Commerce and kind of made the slot machine gesture ka-ching to indicate her support last year. You know, it was the House that was expected to be the stumbling block. But earlier this spring, the House did pass a version of this bill. Basically, what the House version is 2 resort-style casinos and slot machines at probably some of the state's racetracks. And that's a nod to the racetracks, which, of course, have had struggles of the past few years. The Senate version that passed last night is different. This is 3 resort-style casinos, not slots at the racetracks. And what that means is the 2 very different bills that are going to have to be hammered out in conference committee. And the clock is ticking. The legislative calendar year ends on July 31. The fiscal year ends June 30th, but the legislative business calendar ends July 31. So they're going to try to get this done in the next month. The conference committee hopefully will hammer out the differences, and we'll have to wait and see what comes out of it. But it is a big step forward with the Senate vote last night.
Yeah, the debate got a little odd throughout the week as these delays mounted up. We saw 2 communities that we're familiar with, New Bedford and Fall River. They're competing, it seems, for one of the locations for one of the resort-style casinos. And then their legislators start to get in on it and have their own political maneuvering. So I think that held things up as well. So they're heading off to a conference committee. They're going to hammer out the differences. And one of the things they're going to do possibly in a conference committee is take a look at the Mashpee Wampanoag and see what role they might play in this. They're in a limbo situation right now.
They are. And in fact, you know, it was some of the news this week related to the Mashpee Wampanoag that I think sort of broke the logjam in the Senate, because it had been that the Mashpee Wampanoag were going to get preferential, or an Indian casino was going to get preferential treatment, basically an inside track to get one of the resort-style casinos. And of course, the debate is long. We know the meandering road. For a while, the Mashpee Wampanoag under the previous administration were going to do their own thing, regardless of what the state did. Senator Cromwell, the current chairman, said, we want to work with the state. And so they worked out a bit of a compromise this winter, basically saying that the Mashpee Wampanoag would not create their own casino. They would work with the state guidelines and give the state a portion of the money if they did have an inside track. And so that looked good. Then it looked like the tribe was having trouble getting land taken into trust. They had some other hurdles to get over. And some politicians said, well, maybe we won't give them a nod after all. And they pulled back. The Mashpee Wampanoag at the time said, that's a mistake. We're still on track. You're going to find out that that's the case. And this week, they had 2 very significant things happen in their favor. Number one, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was directed to look at tribes such as the Mashpee Wampanoag and say, they can, and others, take land into trust. This is an issue that goes back to the 2009 Supreme Court decision, which basically stopped in its tracks any Indian tribes that had gained federal recognition after 1934 being able to basically identify lands that were not necessarily reservations as their property. And what you do with places like that is you could have housing, you could have human service things, or you could have, as is the case in many places, casinos. That's what the Mashpee Wampanoag want to do. To an extent, that's what the Aquinnah Wampanoag want to do. So the fact that they were not moving that forward was a real stumbling block for the tribes, especially since they're looking originally in Middleborough and now in Fall River to build a casino. Well, Ken Salazar, who we know, of course, from the Cape Wind debate, came out and issued a memo Monday saying, no, we understand the Supreme Court ruling, but that doesn't mean all progress should stop. He directed the Bureau of Indian Affairs to seek a legal opinion, and in the meantime, told all these things to start moving forward. So the tribe said hooray. The state Senate said uh-oh, because that meant that they needed to get the tribe basically back to the table. And so we'll see what happens there. And it's casinos started moving forward. The other thing they did as part of the debate is they basically took a deed restriction off a property in Fall River. That the Mashpee Wampanoag has been looking at, that basically was not going to allow either casinos or landfills to be built there. Those are the two restrictions. Very interesting. It used to be state land that was sort of open space forestry land, and they said, no, we're gonna allow development, but no casinos, no landfills. Well, this week they lifted that restriction, and that's good news for the tribe. It's about 300 acres. It's what the tribe eyes for building a casino. And it's interesting. It originally was being looked at for a biotech park, sort of a business incubator. And it was Fall River lawmakers who said, no, we don't want to do that after all. We want a casino. These are the sort of jobs that we want to see come to the region. So let's move forward with that. So those are two good news for the tribe, and it helped affect the debate, I think.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons the state officials are really looking at a casino is because the budget crisis continues. And this week we heard from the governor. He has signed a budget, and it includes some cuts, some actual cuts that should affect cities, towns, and schools.
Right. And, this is the same story we've seen for the past couple of years. The budget, which is about $27.5 billion for the state, is a significant reduction in any number of things, from local aid down about 4% this year to human services that are getting cut, things that were real sacred cows for politicians, and in particular for Governor Patrick, are not only on the table now, but are on the chopping block. And in an election year, you can imagine these are things that the governor wasn't looking to do. The legislature, both House and Senate, didn't want to do. But the bottom line is the revenue wasn't there. And so they've made these reductions. We will wait and see what the reductions in things like local aid mean. At the end of the day, what it will amount to is that each of the 351 cities and towns in the Commonwealth are going to have to cut out something, whether it's municipal services, whether it's school services. It's going to have an effect. And I think we're going to start to see those ripples over the next month or so as they start to digest what the actual revenue incoming is. And then you have other programs. And one thing that we wrote about this week was a dental program. This was part of sort of Massachusetts healthcare initiative, and it got a lot of people dental care that weren't getting it otherwise. They've been taking off the rolls and millions of dollars, and I think it affects about 40,000 people on the Cape. And that's big numbers of people who are going to basically have to go to community health centers to get their dental care. And already some of these places are completely overwhelmed. One place we talked to, I think it was in Mashpee, said that they treat about 700 dental patients a month, and the waiting list for non-emergencies is about 2 months. So it's really crazy, and this is just going to multiply it by probably tenfold. So it's bad news. I think most people anticipated they'd have bad news. I'm not sure they knew it would be this bad, and we're just braced and trying to deal with it. And you know how this is going to go. We're going to see stories now of from homeless agencies to healthcare to any sort of human services provider saying, look, the money we expected isn't here. What are we going to do? And for some, that means they're going to have to close their doors or cut some of their services or lay people off. And one other note, even at the state level, and again, this is not good in an election year for the governor. His spokesperson said they're looking at layoffs of state employees. Now, last year, they had more than 1,000 layoffs. And this year, his spokesperson said he would be very surprised if it was less than 1,000 again. So big doings with the budget.
Right, and that'd be another 1,000 jobs on top of the 2,600 they've already eliminated since this recession began. And as you said, those cuts to local aid, and that could lead to some local budget cuts and some obviously budget cuts and maybe some job cuts as well. So not good news again on the budget front. Locally, folks have been looking at this Plymouth Rock Studios, this Hollywood East plan, and hoping that could bring some jobs to this region. And we all know the Hollywood tykes love to come to the Cape and Islands for good reason, and we love to have them here. But then we had some news that there's some financing of this project that isn't looking like it's going to come through.
Yeah, and you know, we started to catch wind about this. I think it was in the fall, basically, maybe it was in the winter, where Plymouth Rock Studios seemed to be charging ahead. They were going to sign an agreement to purchase land. They were doing job interviews. They were having people come in, you know, these big floods of people. And there was a ton of excitement. You know, the big Hollywood East sign was going up on the lawn of Plymouth Town Green. You know, really good stuff. And it looked like everything was happening for Plymouth Rock and happening fast. Then all of a sudden, it felt like the plug got pulled and all the water rushed out of the sink because the money they expected just didn't come through. And you wondered at the time what was up. And they were pretty tight-lipped about it. And, you know, I would imagine deals like this are pretty loosely constructed in the beginning anyway. So, you know, the fact that the deal is falling through wasn't necessarily cause for alarm. But you do have to wonder what's behind it. And as it turns out, there possibly is some criminal activity behind it. A gentleman by the name of Michael Burgess, who runs an investment firm in Florida, had promised to loan $550 million to Plymouth Rock, basically to get this up and running. He asked for an investment up front. I think it was in the neighborhood of about $3.5 million to basically make it happen. And then he was going to have a schedule of returned payments. Well, he missed the schedule and nothing seemed to be happening. Well, this week we find out that Mr. Burgess is being charged with 42 counts of either wire fraud or conspiracy to commit wire fraud. Basically, took the money and ran, according to federal authorities. So they've really thrown the book at him. If you add up all the possible penalties associated with these 42 charges, he would spend something in the neighborhood of 845 years in jail and pay back about $10 million in fines. So he faces some pretty stiff charges. It explains a lot of what happened to Plymouth Rock. Now, what is going to happen with Plymouth Rock? They still are trying to get reorganized, and they're looking for other financial sources. I think that they believe that the concept is still sound. Obviously, they have a lot of enthusiasm around here. Massachusetts in general has been trying to sort of capitalize on the film industry for some time now. So maybe they're going to get back up and running. We'll see. But the key is, as we just found out, when you lose that big fundamental building block, the money, then it's going to go nowhere. And as it is right now, it's nowhere.
Bit of a strange story over on Nantucket last week when we heard that 9 Nantucket beaches were being closed. And that was odd this time of year to see so many beaches being closed and the results that they got from water testing. And then just a couple of days later, we heard that the beaches are opening again.
Right. You know, when you have 9 public beaches in a small area, that's a lot. I mean, you can have a couple beach closings, but to basically have every public beach on the island of Nantucket closed, this something is up with that. Either there's a serious problem or there's a mistake. And that's what the health agents at the time even said. During those initial stories, they said, look, there's something up here. The tests are funky. We're going to follow the state protocol and basically not supposed to tell people not to swim at the beaches. Interesting. I was going to say they closed the beaches, but they didn't close the beaches.
Really?
Well, the beaches weren't actually open, as they said. It's kind of a nuance here, as you might imagine, because if I'm going to the beach, whether there's a lifeguard in the chair or not, I'm going in the water. But they did put up signs that said, high bacteria counts, don't go swimming. Some people listened to it. Some people didn't. It was the Friday before the 4th of July weekend that we're about to enter. So just most public schools are out. It's when summer really starts. So the fact that Nantucket was basically closing its beaches for business, even for one day, was a serious concern. The good news for them was that they conducted tests, and you have to have, as we all know from Falmouth's water woes, 2 consecutive so-called clean tests of the water. And that's what Nantucket officials endeavored to do. They got the test results back and the health agent came over to the Cape, flew it to the Barnstable County, and they got the test results back in time to open the beaches for Saturday. So that was good news. They were open for the weekend, and it sort of confirmed his suspicions. They believed that they had used containers that had been basically sitting around for a year. Now, they were sealed with lids, but, you know, they worried that maybe they were no longer sterile, and that might have affected the test results. So so far, so good. The beaches are clean. People are swimming. And, you know, here's here's the deal. This happens from time to time. Right. Not normally this early in the season, but as we get into the hotter weather, especially if you get after a lot of rain, you know, the groundwater runoff is going to raise that bacteria count, and for a day or two, public beaches are going to be closed, even big public beaches. The good news about, you know, ocean beaches is it's sort of a big flushing mechanism every time the tide rolls in and out. So usually those bacteria counts go down within a day or two. So this is the first. It's sort of a shot across the bow for all of us, and just points out once again how fragile our ecosystem is, and apparently so is the testing system.
State officials made another announcement this week, and that's that the great white sharks are back.
Oh, so
will be back. Oh, you're psyched. Yeah. Okay. Does that mean we're going to see an uptick in tourism again? It was bizarre last year. Sharks are in the water. Come on down. And everyone, you know.
Don't go to the water, but just come on down.
Yeah, come on down. Take a look.
Right. I think only Greg Scommel and I are really excited about this. But,
and he's the biologist for the state?
He's Matt Hooper for Massachusetts, you know, the guy who – Richard Dreyfuss character in Jaws. He is the shark expert. You know, he kind of became known to a lot of folks when that one great white shark kind of got trapped in the lagoon on Nauchon Island a few years ago, probably 6-7 years ago now. And Greg Scommel came down, and it was a real curiosity. The shark couldn't get out. And for Scommel and for a lot of people, it was the first time to really get an up close and personal view of a great white shark. And get a sense of the science related to it. What's its habitat? Where does it go? What's it do? So much is not known about great white sharks. And so they ended up finally tagging that shark, and off it went. It was such a fluke that they thought they're not going to get an opportunity like this again. The tag basically popped off before they got any data. That was the bad news. The good news for the likes of Greg Scommel is that it was not an anomaly. As it turned out, there are a lot of great sharks, great white sharks, in and around the area. We know they're in the water, but they seem to be coming closer to shore. And in particular, where they were spotted, five, in fact, last year, was off the coast of Monomoy Island in Chatham, where there's basically a seal colony that's been growing and growing over the years. So that's kind of like a shark buffet counter. So it's not surprising that they're around, and again, they're planning to do the similar research this year. Scommel and others. Interesting. They saw a fisherman saw the first great white. He was a fisherman out of Gloucester, but it was kind of close to the Cape, and so they had a huge press conference at the New England Aquarium. Said the sharks are here. Don't worry, it's still safe to swim. And in fact, it is important to point out that it's safe to swim. The last fatal shark attack was in 1936. It was in Mattapoisett in Buzzards Bay. So, you know, I think people don't have to worry too much. But of course, you know, the notion of a great white shark conjures up all these images. So people do get concerned. Kind of to your question about tourism, I think, and this is interesting, I think it will sort of inspire a degree of tourism. Already out of Chatham, you have seal watch cruises, and you know, people go in and around Monomoy and just check out the seals. I mean, they get up close and personal. People have already been calling and saying, "Hey, we want to go on the shark cruise." And the same guys who are operating the seal boats say, "Okay, but we can guarantee you you'll see seals, but we can't guarantee you see a shark." But they think that's going to be an uptick in business for them, and we'll see.
Provincetown, there's a condom controversy that just keeps continuing here. The story's not going away. And the superintendent there came out, made some apologies, blamed the media. What's going on in Provincetown? What did the media do this time?
That's
Paul?
Right. It's our fault. But, well, I mean, and in fairness, I think the superintendent has a bit of a point. Beth Singer is the superintendent of schools there. They created a policy to distribute condoms in the public schools. The thing they did or didn't do that a lot of school districts do when they create these policies is have some age restrictions. Basically, they had no language in there whatsoever about an age restriction. So theoretically, a kid of any age in the public schools from first grade up to high school could walk into the nurse's office, have a consultation with the nurse, and get a condom. Well, and that's how it played out in a lot of places. You know, there was, I think it was described as a phalanx of Boston TV trucks came down when this story sort of broke open to, you know, do the first graders can get the condoms in Provincetown schools. it's not that simple, of course, but I think the superintendent admitted the language probably could be cleaned up. Even the governor
called the superintendent.
Right. And so, you know, on one hand, maybe the story was overblown by some in the media, because interesting, this policy went through several public hearings. The Provincetown Banner had stories on it. No one really said a peep. Then it's on TV, and some people have concerns. So, you know, you can see the fanning of the flames effect going on. On the other hand, you can also see why it created such a buzz, because here's a policy that did, in fact, allow anyone to walk into the schools. Get this. Parents had no say whatsoever in stopping it. So, you know, they're going to rewrite it a bit. And again, the superintendent, as you said, sent a letter apologizing for the media frenzy and the disruption that it caused. But in the end, I think it's going to end up probably with a better policy. Interesting. Provincetown is only one of three schools that has such a policy. Nantucket does as well, and Falmouth has for a long time. And I'm sure they won't be alone. I'm sure others will follow this example and say, well, let's be very careful with how we frame this language. It's all in the words, as we know.
And it wouldn't be a news roundup without a story about Cape Wind. And this week, the story is about the Massachusetts Audubon Society coming out with a press release in full support of Cape Wind after what they say was a decade of research.
Right. And, you know, the backdrop to this one is, of course, that there were lawsuits filed last week by the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound and others, the town of Barnstable, and several environmental groups concerned about a host of things. And one thing interesting, the town of Barnstable keyed on sort of the flight patterns that they believe have, and I don't know if this is true or not, but they say have been changed in recent time and wasn't taken into account in the plans for the Cape Wind. Some of the environmental groups keyed on other things, such as the effect on endangered species from whales to birds. And so the timing, you can see with this lawsuit coming out, is pretty clear. Mass Audubon has signaled their support for Cape Wind in the past, and this is certainly by far their most declarative statement that after, as you said, 10 years of research, they believe this project should go forward. Opponents of the wind farm said, well, maybe there's a conflict of interest here, because basically what Mass Audubon has asked for is a continuing avian study once this project is constructed. They want to see what exactly is the effect, because right now it's fairly theoretical, is always the case before you build something. Mass Audubon has not recused itself, so if this study does become part of the criteria, maybe they get a contract, maybe they financially benefit. That's something some of the opponents have said. Mass Audubon turns around and says that it's baloney. I mean, even if that were the case, that's not where we make our money. We've made our money for generations off membership dues, and that will be the case in the future. So they believe it's just a project that should move forward. They've weighed the, as many have done, as probably all have done, the pros and cons of this project, and where Mass Audubon comes down is in favor.
Also on the environmental front, reversing red tide. There was a feature in the Cape Cod Times this week about an effort by Hui scientists to reverse some of the red tide in Nauset Marsh Estuary in Eastham.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting story, and I didn't know this, but there are only two places in the North Atlantic seaboard, the New England area, that actually have their own red tide cyst fields. One is in that Nauset Estuary, and the other is off the coast of Maine. And the reason I didn't know that is because you hear about red tide closing, you know, all sorts of areas, beaches in the North Shore, South Shore, down to the Cape, down to Rhode Island. But basically what happens in most places is the cyst fields are coming from Maine, and they're drifting down and affecting the region down here. Nauset has sort of its own cyst field, and this goes back about 40 years, where there was a serious outbreak of red tide, and some of the red tide came to the surface. Others basically hardened into cysts and fell down into the sediment around the estuary, and they come up from time to time when the weather conditions are correct. And so it's a recurring problem. And again, unlike other parts of the coastline, where you really can't affect it or change it because it's blowing in, there it's basically the same cysts that come and go, come and go. And so they started to take a look at this because the Army Corps of Engineers was doing, as they often do, was doing some dredging work and asked Don Anderson, who's a red tide expert at HUI, what effect it would be if they upset the ground, basically, on the ecosystem. And Don took a look at it and said, you know what? It wouldn't have a bad effect. In fact, it might have a good effect because these cysts, when you basically till the soil, would be buried. And once they're buried, the oxygen is choked off and it kills them. So they decided maybe we should do a pilot program. And they got about a $350,000 grant from NOAA to basically test out this theory that Anderson has of either tilling the underwater soil or dropping a thin layer of sand, which would basically choke off the red tide cysts. So they're going to pick a couple spots in the estuary. One is in Salt Pond, which people will probably be able to see. And they're going to do a number of different things. They're going to just, again, layer some sand down there as if it were cranberry bog. They're going to send divers down and basically brush it away and kind of do an underwater rototill. So we'll see if it works. If it does, it could be a big advancement and certainly good news for the estuary. We'll see.
And this week we heard about a wrongful death suit that's been settled, and this is a story that the Cape Cod Times has really moved along and not let go of, and there was, why don't you tell me about that, a death of a Mashpee man.
Yeah, really terrible story. Daniel Ryan was in Cape Cod Hospital to visit his wife, who was a patient there, on October 29th. Something happened, and he was taken into the emergency room for evaluation himself. During the course of his evaluation, he was not happy. He broke away and was chased down by security. They had an altercation that resulted ultimately in his death, something that the coroner has labeled a homicide. So since then, two different tracks, a criminal and a civil track, have been underway. And the criminal track is not yet settled. As far as we know, the district attorney says a coroner's inquest has been underway to look and see if anything should move forward to a grand jury. We'll wait and see on that one. Meanwhile, on the civil side, and this is what was settled this week, the family brought a suit against Cape Cod Hospital, and it was settled. We don't know the terms of the suit. In fact, the suit didn't even give the security officer's name, although one specific person was cited in this action. Some money has been put aside. Apparently, it's in a trust to go to Ryan's children. And at least that chapter of this very sad story has come to a close. The hospital said they're happy to reach an agreement. And I guess we're all going to wait and see what the next step is, because if, in fact, this goes to a grand jury and if charges are brought forward against anyone, we're probably going to be hearing a lot more. As it is, as you pointed out, the Times has been banging away at this story with public records requests. And that's when I think everyone learned a lot about the circumstances of this case. So it's a really, really terrible story.
4th of July weekend is upon us. The tourists are arriving and getting ready for different activities there.
It's going to be a great weekend, isn't it, Sean? It's going to be a heat wave, I think. And you know, the streets are filled with foreign plates, you know, people wandering, left-hand turns. It's going to be great. But no, we're here. We love the Cape and the Islands. We're gonna grin and bear it and fire up the grill.
Oh, love it. Absolutely. More than merrier. I want to thank Paul Pronovo, the editor of the Cape Cod Times, for coming in today. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Sean.
And thanks to Mindy Todd for asking me to sit in for her. Mindy will be back next week. I'm Sean Corcoran. I'm a reporter here at WCAI. Thanks for listening.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.